900 AM and Federal News Radio.
This may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And a lot of good stuff is happening in technology, as always. We'll talk a little bit about the blue light-emitting diode. That were noted by the Nobel Prize in Physics Committee.
Mm-hmm.
They made a great award there in physics. Kmart, had some hackers breach their payment system, and we've got an update on the space elevator.
Ooh,
yeah,
which we couldn't get to last week.
We couldn't.
We just had so much stuff.
So much stuff is going on, and really the breakthrough is really in nanotube technology, because it's really a materials problem, and which I'll explain a little bit as we get further into the show.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it was a huge, huge mailbag.
Giant.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Oh, yeah.
Don't hurt yourself.
Oh, I'm going to try not to. We got an email from Bob in Maryland. Dear Doc, friends of mine asked me about recovering files from a partially backed up hard drive. It was in a laptop that was dropped. Now, software has been run on the drive and it's been installed in another machine to no avail. Is there a service in D.C. that you recommend for hard drive information recovery if the disk housing has to be opened up because of some mechanical damage? I, of course, am assuming the disk has not been cracked or shattered. P.S. The last few shows have been incredible. Ivan, listen more than once if I get a chance. I've stopped listening to the other computer radio shows since I get so much more out of Tech Talk. Thanks, Bob in Maryland, a loyal listener and fellow physicist.
Well, he just made it to the top of your list.
He definitely
did.
Well, first of all, Bob, I'd recommend that the drive be taken out of the laptop and connected to it through a USB port to another computer. You can get a USB enclosure quite cheap. You don't even need an enclosure. You can just plug it into an adapter, probably. For less than $20, you can do that. And then if you can do that, you can boot up on the other machine, and then you can see whether any of the files can be seen in that hard drive. I couldn't tell whether you'd removed it from the laptop or not. If they still cannot be seen and the hard drive, in fact, is not functioning, there are disk recovery services. Now, they are expensive. They're going to cost you several hundred dollars to go in and recover the data, but it is easily done because the data is really there. And they open these things up, they put them in a clean room, they reassemble them, and they can really recover the data extremely well. Now, there is a local recovery service called the Salvage Data Recovery Service. Salvage Data Recovery Service. They've got an office in Herndon and an office in Washington, D.C. So you can take your hard drive there, and they'll, for a few hundred bucks, they'll recover the data for you.
So basically, you could, if you didn't need to get that far, you could buy a sleeve to slide the hard drive into that's got a USB port on it?
Yeah.
How much does something like that cost?
No, it's not even a sleeve. You can actually get – I got one at home. I just plug it onto the USB. It gets the power from the USB, and I just plug it onto the hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a connection point where I can plug in a USB. And so for like $16, I got a system that allowed me to take the floppy hard drive and plug it into a USB port. Now, if you want a whole enclosure, so you've got a whole external hard drive system, that might be like $22.
So what is the disk in a hard drive made of?
It's metal. It's very thin, a layer of metal with magnetic material coated to both sides.
So it is possible. He mentioned here if it has, you could actually crack it, right?
Yeah, it's pretty unlikely. Normally, what happens is the head crashes on the disk and scratches the magnetic material. It's very rare that the disk itself breaks.
If that happens, can you not get the data off of it?
Well, what What would happen in that case if you could not get the data from the place where it was scratched? Now, if the scratch has occurred right in, say, the boot sector, then you wouldn't be able to boot the disk up. But the data in the rest of the drive is still there.
Gotcha.
So what they do is they go in here and they recover the data from the rest of the drive. Mm-hmm. And these might be full files or fragmented files. And then once you recover the data, then you can sort through it to figure out what you've got. So, I mean, one time I had a hard drive that crashed, and I got actually a low-level formatting tool, and I went into my hard drive, and I actually removed file by file by file the entire hard drive. And I must have spent about 3 or 4 hours doing it manually, but I was able to reconstruct almost all the data from that hard drive manually.
Wow.
So if you go to these services, they do it for you, and you don't have to go through all of that. And they're pretty reliable, and they're by and large going to get most of the data.
Good. Cool.
So that's actually a pretty good option for you. And we've got some very good data recovery services in this area. Salvage Data Recovery in either Herndon or Washington. Just Google them and you'll get them. We got an email from Arnie. Hi, Dr. Schertz. A while back, you discussed security for various browsers and mentioned that Firefox did not have a sandbox to provide additional security. My question is, security also diminished in Thunderbird, which is the Mozilla email service that runs under Firefox. Does an email service need a sandbox also? Thanks. Great show. By the way, I also listen online since 1500 AM isn't available in Crownsville. Arnie in Crownsville, Maryland. Arnie, you could also download the TuneIn application.
Yes.
For your iPhone, and then you don't have to go online. You just click on TuneIn, and bingo, you've got it. That's whenever I'm traveling and want to listen to Tech Talk, or I have other people traveling, I can always use TuneIn. And that really works great. So half of the radio stations, depending on what group you're in, are in TuneIn. And, in fact, Federal News Radio is on TuneIn. The other stations are on iHeartRadio. So those.
But you don't really want to listen to those stations.
Oh, yeah. You don't want to listen
to
those stations.
No, the stations that are worth listening to are in TuneIn Radio.
TuneIn Radio.
And it's free.
And it's free, yeah. I was just trying to give Arnie a complete picture. Maybe I'm not allowed to talk about iHeartRadio on the air.
No, I have a personal problem with those people. But that's just me.
Okay. Well, you are right. Thunderbird does not have a sandbox, just like Firefox. But it's a little bit not quite as dangerous, though. You see, in the case of a browser, you're going to different web pages, and there could be malicious code there that could take, and it loads before you even know what you've got going. In the case of an email client, you could actually disable the email preview pane if you wanted, and then it would not be a problem. Now, what I actually use, I use a web-based email client. So if I use Chrome browser and I go to Gmail, I'm opening up Gmail within Chrome, and Chrome has a sandbox. So automatically my email is inside of the Chrome sandbox. Mm-hmm. And so you could actually do that. Even Internet Explorer's got a sandbox now. It's just that Firefox didn't have a sandbox. They were the only one without a sandbox. And actually Mozilla has actually been behind the power curve on all the security issues. So so if you're using that Thunderbird, I would just be very careful about any attachments that you open. That would be my advice, and because there is no sandbox there. And then we also got an email from Jim, who is across the console from
me.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's right. And he said, "I'm interested in making my own app, and wondered how expensive is it? How do I do it? Is it a big deal? What's going on here?" And I've got an idea, and I'd like to try to capitalize on it. Well, Jim, if you've ever wanted to build an app for your business or your blog or your any kind of service, that you don't really have to invest a lot of time and money to get it done now, because entering the market now are a whole lot of platforms that are available for building your app, and you don't need any coding knowledge at all.
Really?
They're just there.
No kidding.
Because, and the reason that these platforms are there is that all of the smartphone manufacturers want more people to build apps, and they don't want to have, you know, all these coding barriers, so they want to make platforms that make it really convenient. So there are a couple, I mean, there are several, there are like probably six or seven really good ones out there. I'm just going to list two today.
Okay.
One is Appery.io.
Mm-hmm.
Appery.io. Appery.io is a cloud-based mobile app builder they can use to create apps for Android, iOS, Windows Phone. It also includes Apple, Apache, Cordova, with access to built-in components. Since the builder runs on the cloud, there's nothing to install or download. It's easy to get started quickly. It includes a visual editor using drop-and-drag components to build your user interface. You can connect any sort of API to it, use it for your app. You can instantly add a cloud database and back end to your app if you need to store data. You can add powerful functionality with the Appery plugin catalog or create your own custom private plugins to use in your apps. That's if you want to write code, Jim. But I'm thinking you're going to want to use the catalog.
I think you're right.
Collaboration is simple. It allows you to share your mobile project with development teams, business users, and customers in real time. Get this. The plan starts at free. And if you want to go all the way up to premium, it's $180 a month. So you could start for free, try it out. And then if you want to have all sorts of features like multiple developers interacting and all sorts of other stuff, mm-hmm. you can go up, spend up to $180 per month. Now, the second one is Mobile Roadie. Mobile, Roadie, R-O-A-D-I-E. Mobile Roadie is an app creator that allows anyone to create and manage their own iOS or Android app. The platform supports all media type with automatic importing of RSS. That would be really simple syndication. That would be podcasts or blogs, Twitter or Google News keywords. It has an auto-refresh fan wall through which users can chat with each other in real time. You can use the free Mobile Roadie Connect app to preview your app accurately, just as you would on your device. The app also guides you through the submissions process. Mobile Roadie will check your quality and the appropriateness of your content. You can push content straight up to your app and pull content from your own site or blog. The API is language agnostic, so you can pull data in a variety of formats. You can pull data in either XML, JSON, PHP, CSV or HTML. You can easily craft a custom look and feel for your app and apply it to all platforms. You can use a suite of marketing tools, which is really important once your app is launched, because you got to sell it.
Right.
Now, the plans, now these plans are more expensive. This
sure.
is like a kind of an upgraded deal. This mm-hmm. is like, they start at $125 a month for the core, and they go up to $667 a month for the pro. So what I gave you was kind of the low end and the high end.
Okay.
So if you really start building up and start making money out of this deal, you might be able to move up. But
how is it? So I come up with this app,
uh-huh.
and how do I get it onto iPhone so that they offer it to people?
So you upload it to iTunes. This is the thing, and then iTunes has to run it through their checks.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually have a quality check on it,
uh-huh.
and so Apple will actually check your app to make, first of all, that it complies with all policies that they have. They don't want you to sell stuff unless they get a 30% cut. They're always looking at that.
Okay.
They're looking for the appropriateness of the content, and they also look at the security feature. Is it secure? And so they will actually, it might take them 90 days to approve an app. And so there is a bit of a barrier there, and they'll keep emailing you. So people complain about that, but The apps, if they are finally approved by Apple, then are secure and they're safe for users to use.
And if it's not something that they approve, they'll kick it back and say, this is the problem, you've got to fix this, and then you can work on it and send it back in, that sort of thing.
See, on the other hand, Android doesn't really check the apps that much.
They just throw it out there.
You can throw out anything there. That's why you've got to be a little more careful when you download an Android app.
Didn't know that.
But the Apple apps are pretty well screened, and so it is a process, and so that second site, you see, they said that they will help you submit it. Submitting it to Apple is submitting it. The app also guides you through the submission process.
So it kind of helps to get you toward the front of the line.
Yeah, so that is the deal. So actually, I think if you got an idea, just play around with these. You don't have to be a code guy to actually make an app
that's
pretty good.
I talked to somebody who said, you know, it's going to cost you like $5,000 to put this together. And I'm like, no.
Yeah, that's of course if you go and hire somebody, but
right.
you can play around with these things.
I think I'd rather try that first.
Yeah, that's what I would do.
Interesting. Doc, thank you for the help. This is Tech Talk Radio, Saturday morning on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. Stand by. More of Tech Talk coming up right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn by doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives, one student at a time.
The following Profiles in IT segment aired originally on October 11, 2008. Please stay with us after that for your chance to play the pop quiz and a lot more new information here on Tech Talk Radio.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge of Stratford University talking technology, and now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
And today we're going to talk about Jonathan Paul Ive, mm-hmm. I-V-E. Jonathan Paul Ive is the principal designer of the iMac, the aluminum PowerBook G4, the Mac Pro, MacBook Pro, the iPod, and the iPhone. He's casually known as Johnny Ive. Johnny Ive was born February 1967 in London and grew up in Chingford, Essex. Yeah, that's right. In interviews, that would be in England, of course. In interviews, Jonathan has spoken about always being interested in the construction of objects as a child and a fascination with taking those objects apart. After attending school in the south of England, he moved to the north of England to study art and design at Newcastle Polytechnic, which is now Northumbria University, in 1985. He graduated with first-class honors, having created a pebble-shaped concept for a product to replace cash and credit cards in his final year project. A pebble-shaped project? Isn't that like trading with beads?
Yeah, I was carrying marbles around in your pocket. Yeah.
In 1990, Jonathan moved to London and co-founded his own design studio called Tangerine with Martin Derbyshire. He created projects ranging from hair combs and power tools to televisions and ceramics. Now, Jonathan's biggest contract was with Standard Ideal, where he designed toilets, seeking inspiration from marine biology books.
I wish there were pictures. I'm going to see if I can find pictures of that while you're talking.
Apple Computer was a client of Tangerine, And Jonathan made a sample laptop computer design and showed it to Steve Jobs, and they liked it. So he joined the Apple team. Now, this was, however, at the low point of Apple. Immediately after he was hired by Apple, Steve Jobs was ousted in a boardroom coup orchestrated by John Sculley. Do you remember that?
I sure do, yes.
Now, after Scully came on board, he's just looking at the bottom line, he outsourced all the design work. This was when they were going to have third-party apps running on Apple computers, and Apple was losing grounds to Microsoft Windows day by day. Actually, Johnny Ive almost quit because he, as a designer, he joined full-time, and then they outsourced the design work. But in 1997, Steve Jobs returned and began to revive Apple's fortune and return it to the industry leader that it is today. Now, Johnny Ive was instrumental in this turnaround. The first thing he did after Jobs came back, he says, are there any designs in the back room that have been deep-sixed by Scully? Bingo! Johnny came up with all of his designs, and Steve loved them. And that was the beginning of the new Apple look.
Mm-hmm.
Under the new Jobs-led Apple, Ive was promoted to Senior Vice President of Industrial Design, and he launched the visually stunning iMac G3, and that was regarded as the birth of what they now call the new Apple. And that brought Jonathan to the attention of everybody outside of Apple because it was quite a nice design. From the iBook to the PowerBook, all of Apple's products have met with universal acclaim and became instant masterpieces. Jonathan brought simplicity, elegance, innovation to everything he touched. His the minimalist styling of the iPhone with only one button on the front is the signature of Johnny Ive. See, I always thought maybe the iPhone is really the Ive phone.
Uh-huh.
Did you ever think about that?
Yeah, it's interesting.
You know, I wonder,
I'm thinking about it now.
I wonder where the iPod, the iPod, or the iMac.
It just doesn't have the same...
The iMac.
The iMac.
I mean, if I were the designer, it would be the S-Mac. But that's Smac.
And
that's no good.
No, it's not.
No, and so I wonder whether the I... Or I always thought the I stood for Internet, but now I'm thinking maybe it stands for Ive. Now, Jonathan's work is influenced by many things. The original color-candied iMac had its roots in gumdrops. He wanted to make a computer that looked kind of like a gumdrop.
Mm-hmm.
The transparent Apple mouse came from thinking about how water drops look when they're sitting on a flat surface. The see-through outer casing of recent iBooks came from the look that food has when it's wrapped in plastic wrap. The iPod is like a cigarette pack to those who are addicted to music instead of tobacco. This is his thinking. The sunflower inspired the iMac G4. Now, the thing is, you never hear about Johnny Ive because he is a very modest and shy person who basically seems very uncomfortable even talking about himself. Now, he's won the prestigious D&AD Award. This is a huge designer award. Actually, he's won it 6 times. And a designer, to even win it once, is just an enormous honor. It's a worldwide award. When he goes and wins that award, he doesn't even go up to receive it. Steve Jobs goes up, receives the award for him, and makes the acceptance speech on his behalf, even though he's sitting in the audience.
Interesting.
So he's just a kind of a shy guy. He lives modestly, inhabiting a 2-bedroom house in Twin Peaks, San Francisco, with his wife, Heather, who's a historian, and their 2 twin sons. So now you know the name of the man behind all of the Apple designs. One man, Jonathan Paul Ive.
Very interesting, and I've been looking around while you're talking about him. I can't find any pictures of the toilets that he designed.
I'd like to see the toilet.
Yeah, well, we'll have to keep
looking. Well, there is a story about the toilet. Okay, they actually lost the toilet contract. He went in, he designed...
So they flushed it, huh?
No. This is really outside of the scope of the... But he went to make a presentation to the director of marketing at the toilet company.
Mm-hmm.
The director of marketing sat and watched him demonstrate his new innovative toilet. But the director of marketing had a red clown nose stuck on his nose as he was watching the presentation. So Johnny knew they were in trouble.
Yeah, I would say that's definite trouble.
Right after that, he went to Apple.
Well, good. It all worked out for all of us.
That's right.
Yep.
Thank you for tuning in or logging on. It's Saturday morning, and you're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. Online at techtalkonline.com or federalnewsradio.com. Learn more about our sponsors at stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio, IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Master's in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. Nope, it's not Monty Hall. It's not Ed McMahon. It's not Dr. Richard Schertz. It's this guy right here.
And I will be that aforementioned guy right here. My name is Jim Russ. I'm the adjunct professor for messing things up and lowering the academic bar here on Tech Talk Radio. We just got finished talking about Jonathan Paul Ive, the principal designer for all things I, as in iPhone, iMac, iPod. His work over the years has been influenced by many things. So today's question is fill in the blank. The candy color of the original iMac came from... Fill in that blank correctly right now, and you'll win tickets for two for fine dining at the Escoffier at Stratford on the campus in Falls Church, or Cafe Karim at the campus in Woodbridge. The phone lines are open right now. If you're calling from east of Chingford, Essex, Great Britain, it's 877-936-9333. If you're calling from west of Falls Church, Virginia, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, the wild card line is 877-936-9333. Adjunct professor for prize distribution and crowd control, Andrew Mitchell, is standing by to take your calls right now. This is the Pop Quiz from Tech Talk Radio.
The Nobel Prize in Physics has been awarded to three researchers for the invention of the light-emitting diode, the blue light-emitting diode. It's energy efficient and environmentally friendly. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences said the invention was just 20 years old, so you wouldn't really expect it to be such a big deal. But they said it's already contributed to create white light in an entirely new manner. You see, we already had the other colors. We had like the red and the yellow, but we didn't have the blue. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't make white light unless you had all three primary colors. And so blue was the missing item. And they came up with the magic formula for blue. Isamu Akasaki, 85, who's 85, he's a professor at Mieho University and a distinguished professor at Nagoya University. Also receiving it was Hiroshi Amano. He's 54. He's professor at Nagoya University. And Shuji Nakamura, he's 60. He's professor at the University of California at Santa Barbara. These are all Japanese researchers, you might notice.
Didn't we talk about these guys at one point in Profiles in IT?
No, we've never.
We talked about the LED before.
But that was Nick Holonyak, who invented the LED.
Mm-hmm.
So they produced blue light from semiconductors in the 1990s, something that scientists had struggled on for decades. It was really very difficult to get semiconductors with a band gap that large. Now, using blue light, LED... light-emitting diodes, using blue light, LED lamps can emit white light. And as of this time now, about a fourth of the world electricity consumption is used for lighting purposes, and LEDs would contribute to saving the Earth's resources. That's why they said this was so significant.
Mm-hmm.
This will dramatically alter, you know, energy consumption in the Earth. Now, the Nobel Prize is worth $1.1 million each, and they're handed out every December 10th. on the anniversary of the founder's death in 1896. Now, besides the prize money, they get a diploma and a gold medal. Nobel, who created the prize, was a wealthy Swedish industrialist who invented dynamite.
I didn't know that.
And he provided a few, and that's why he felt so bad that he contributed to warfare, because he invented dynamite.
So that's how this whole thing started.
That's why he wanted the Nobel Peace Prize. He was trying to make amends for inventing dynamite.
You never know what you're going to learn by listening
to
the show.
And so he didn't really give instructions on how to select the winners, except the prize committee should reward those who have conferred the greatest benefit to mankind.
That is fascinating. And that is something I didn't know. How about that? You're listening to Tech Talk Radio. It's Saturday morning. We're on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. Learn more about the show by going to techtalkonline.com, and learn more about our sponsors by going to stratford.edu. We'll be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Masters in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Kmart says hackers have breached its payment system. Now, Kmart is the latest of the large U.S. retailers to experience a breach in its payment systems, and is joining a big club of stores that have been hacked successfully. The company said on October 9th that its IT team detected that its payment data systems had been breached, sparking them to start an initial investigation. The company believes debit and credit card numbers have been compromised. The company spokesman told Security Week that they're not able to provide a figure on the number of customers impacted. The spokesman said that based on the forensic information to date, no personal information, no debit card PIN numbers, no email addresses, no social security numbers were obtained by the hackers. The investigation indicated that the breach started early September.
Wow.
Early September, and they've been working with their Kmart store payment data systems, which were infected with a form of malware that was undetectable with the current antivirus systems. They were quickly able to remove the malware. However, they believe that the debit and credit card numbers may have been compromised. The company declined to comment on which security firm was conducting the investigation. Kmart.com does not appear to be impacted. The retailer said it's working with federal law enforcement agencies, iBanking partners, and other IT security firms as part of the ongoing investigation. Now, attackers have access to a range of custom POS malware these days designed to specifically steal credit card and magnetic track data from POS memory. See, all of these companies have POS systems. That's called point-of-sale systems, mm-hmm. POS. Mm-hmm. And so it's the same flavor of malware that's being used on all of these stores, actually. Mark Bowen, VP of Product Marketing at Voltage Security, told Security Week that malware into the POS might come from a direct network intrusion or by subverting the POS software update or the patch management system with an infected update. Once in, the attackers can siphon off every transaction that the customer each time the customer swipes his card until it's detected and removed. So this they're using the same versions of POS going into all of these systems. They're going one store after another after another.
Do you think this is the same group, or is it different groups that are doing
this? It's probably different groups, but I would suspect that the POS malware was written by one group and sold.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like a black market on malware,
so,
and they sell it. And I'd say it's probably different people are doing this.
And it's amazing that no one's been caught in the other ones yet. I mean, Target and Home Depot, those people are still out there, right?
They haven't been caught because they're probably sending these credit card numbers to another country,
mm-hmm.
and they go through a number of servers, and then they probably aren't going to catch them until they try to sell the stuff. So when they try to sell the credit card numbers, they may be able to trace it back.
So at this point, these guys haven't made any money until they sell those credit card numbers, right?
They haven't made any money yet. And mm-hmm. so you'll start expecting to see these credit card numbers and whatever other data they have showing up on the black market within a month or so.
So that's the good news. I mean, for all intents and purposes, as long as they catch – I mean, it's a pain in the neck for everybody, but as long as they catch these guys before they sell the credit card numbers
– right.
There's no...
Now, I would recommend that if anybody feels like they've been shopping at Kmart and their data has been compromised, I'd ask Kmart to pay for an identity theft subscription for at least a year, which is what the other companies are doing.
So do you think that these guys, whoever these people are doing this, know now that they've been shut down? Do they realize that they can't sell those numbers?
No, they'll still sell them.
They're still going to sell them?
Because they're really worth money on the black market.
Mm-hmm.
They'll sell them. They'll sell them anonymously through different sites.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of sites that allow for the anonymous sale, and they'll sell them maybe through other countries.
Where all this is easier to do.
So they basically might sell these to some people in China who would then use them. They're not going to sell them probably to somebody in the U.S.
Yeah, doesn't matter where it is as long as there's money coming out of your account. So we've been talking about the new iPhone and the new technology that you can use to pay with things with the iPhone
mm-hmm.
6.
Yeah.
But as long as you use the double encryption method there, right,
mm-hmm.
that should help protect you from this sort
it
of –
It does. Well, you see, the new payment method actually is pretty good.
Uh-huh.
So let me explain that. This is kind of an aside.
Okay.
What it does is that the credit card number is stored in your iPhone, but when you authorize a payment through near-field communication using the new Apple Pay, which is about to come out, Apple Pay provides a number which can only be used one time for payment from Apple Pay.
Mm-hmm.
And so the company that you're buying from never has your credit card number.
Wow.
They don't have any information. They've got a number which is authorized for one-time use for Apple Pay.
It's like a one-time order number then, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And so Apple Pay, so you tap the phone, you make the payment, your iPhone generates a number that the vendor uses for a one-time payment.
But you can only do this with the 6. You can't do this with the 5.
You can't
do
it with the 5.
Okay. All right.
And so, Google has tried to get some sort of payment system. I think the Apple Pay is going to go because
mm-hmm.
it's going to eliminate a lot of these other issues.
Yeah.
That's a very good. And now we have one of my favorite updates, the space elevator update. Yes. I love the whole space elevator idea. It's basically a cable,
yep.
which is attached to the Earth somewhere around the equator. And as the Earth, and there's a satellite at the end of this cable, the cable's actually around 96,000 miles long. I mean, it's 96,000 kilometers long. Sorry, I want to get to keep that straight.
Boy, do I wish David Byrd was here right
and
now.
And so as the Earth spins around, you got this long cable with a satellite or a weight at the end. It just whips it around. It's held out by centrifugal force. And so that you can then have objects go up and down on the cable, and they basically use magnetic motors, and they can traverse up and down the cable, and you can go from ground level up to outer space by, gliding along this cable. It takes about a week to traverse that distance. It takes about 1 week to get to outer space, but it turns out it's just dirt cheap to launch if you use the space elevator. Now, the problem is that it takes a cable that is so strong that it exceeds the strength of any currently known materials. Now, this space, the concept for the space elevator was proposed 120 years ago, and it was first published by the father of modern rocketry. He's a Russian. His name was Konstantin Tsiolkovsky.
Nicely done.
And he published that in 1895. Now, the reason this is coming up. Oh, by the way, if this thing could actually be pulled off, you could launch payloads into space for just hundreds of dollars per kilogram, mm-hmm. rather than the current cost of $20,000 per kilogram when you launch a rocket. So the cost of launching things into outer space would be dramatically reduced. But this requires a 2.5-inch thick cable that could lift the equivalent of 3 international space stations per day into orbit. Now, the problem is we don't have anything that strong because it's a long cable and right. it just exceeds. So here's why this is an update today. There was a breakthrough in materials technology
okay.
at Penn State University. John Badding, he told CNN that his team has had a breakthrough while examining the properties of the benzene molecule. He said it took them 18 months to figure out and make sense of what the team had been seeing. But these were experiments using benzene, which is normally a liquid, and they put it under extreme pressure until it forms a solid. Now, everybody thought that when benzene formed the solid, it would sort of do it in a disorganized, glassy, amorphous kind of material way. But instead, the benzene formed a solid in a very strict, ordered way. And this occurred, this strict order in the formation of this benzene structure formed at room temperature. It was actually a total shock to the researchers. And it turns out that the structure of this benzene solid is such that they could make nanomaterials that are super strong and that these could be used for lightweight cables with the possible application to the space elevator.
Well, let me ask you this question. Here's the thing that concerns me
yes.
about this. So you got a cable that's 2.5 inches in diameter,
right.
which goes from some place on Earth up into outer space. It's only a matter of time before something crashes into
if
that.
If an airplane hits it, it's the
It rips the wing off a 757.
Yeah, or else it breaks the cable. Well, the cable won't break because it'll be super strong. Yeah, that is if we have space elevators, we're going to have flight control around the space elevator cable.
Here's this. Maybe we can place blue LEDs all along yeah. the cable so people can see it.
So that is one disadvantage of the thing, but you know, maybe we could put it in an area on the Earth where there wasn't so much traffic.
Well, and then think about this. I mean, taking it another step further, if this becomes inexpensive, private industry gets involved in this, and somebody else wants to have their own, and somebody else, and so now we got all these stupid cables coming off.
I'm thinking they're going to be controlled by the by NASA,
the International Cable Coalition, or something like that.
I think they will be, but you can see where if this actually is successful, it's going to transform space travel.
Yeah,
and it'll transform, you know, space station, getting supplies up there, because then we could actually take the space elevator. We could actually put all of our materials in orbit before we launch them to other countries or to other planets. And so it would dramatically alter the cost of space travel.
Well, this would probably be a stupid question, but I'm good at that. What's to keep us then from tethering ourselves to the moon, running the cable all the way to the moon or something like that?
Let's see. If you run it all the way to the moon, I'm trying to think. That may be.
It makes it a lot longer, right?
It makes it longer, but then I just don't know.
But there's nothing to be had on the moon, right?
Yeah, I don't know that would work. I mean, the main cost is escaping, getting up to the escape velocity of the Earth. And so mm-hmm. just getting out of the Earth's gravitational field, I think, is all you need. Making the cable longer, I just don't think it would buy you anything, and it would require even a stronger cable,
sure,
and a longer cable. So I just don't think that would buy you anything. We want to get to a certain altitude,
and then launch from there.
And launch from there, yeah.
Doc Radio Gold, or shall we say Radio Benzene.
Radio Benzene. So there you go. Everything you wanted to know about the space elevator. By the way, there is a company by the name of Obayashi Corporation, and they've been investigating the space elevator concept. Now, their researchers believe that advances in carbon technology will make the space elevator possible as soon as 2030. And the Japanese company, Obayashi Corporation, has been investigating this so that they could actually get this thing done.
I hope David Byrd lives that long so he can see it and maybe travel along the space elevator.
I think David should probably be one of the first people that goes up into the space elevator, and he could and he could do color commentary from the space elevator.
Which floor would you like,
launched.
Sir?
Yes.
This is Tech Talk Radio, Saturday morning on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM, HD2. Up and away. This could only mean one thing.
Yeah. Hi, folks. This is David Burke.
He's here.
Lotus Files? Are we going to go back to DAT now?
Lotus Files? Oh,
wow.
Yeah. I was
Lotus
reading.
Files.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Doc, I came in here just to give you one little factoid here.
Okay.
This morning, I'm driving into work. Right?
Yes.
Stopped at the 7-Eleven. You know what they're selling at the 7-Eleven? Drones.
What?
They're selling a drone at the 7-Eleven, little propellers, the whole thing.
Wow.
I'm sure this is a high-quality item.
Oh, yeah, I'll bet it was.
And was it $39.99?
Right next to the 5-Hour energy drink.
Do you pour the 5-Hour energy drink
really?
Into the drone?
Unbelievable.
For power?
Unbelievable.
Are they delivering Slurpees by drone?
Slurpees by drone. They have little, it's in the little box, and there you go, and boom. It's crazy. This is how it's leveled down to everyone's level now.
Everybody's getting drones.
There's a drone for your price. Whatever your price limit is, there's a drone just for you.
It's like the Yugo of drones.
There was a guy in Seattle. Crickets. He was almost arrested. He was taking pictures of the Space Needle.
I saw that last night on the news. Yeah. Almost got arrested.
No, he wasn't arrested. The police just gave him a warning.
Yeah, quit flying drones up here.
Yeah, see, he was an Amazon employee. But the thing is interesting, he was staying in a hotel that had a balcony. So he launched the drone from the balcony.
What a dope.
And then he listen, what a dope. That's something, that's something.
Oh, I'm
that's
sorry, Doc. I didn't mean you were a dope.
That's something I may do.
Well, no, the balcony. The question is, did he get it? Was he an astute enough pilot?
He got it back.
To get it back into his balcony. So what he did, he
flew it over to the Space Needle. He was flying it around the Space Needle, but then he hit the window at one point.
Oh, jeez.
But it didn't break a propeller. He must have had propeller guards on it, like I have.
Right.
So he was able. So three people called 911 who were at the Space Needle saying that there's an alien ship outside the window, and they called the police. So then he flew it back, and he opened up his patio door in the hotel room, and he just flew it right back into the hotel.
Wow. Did he turn himself in? Or
No. The police watched where it went.
Oh, very clever.
And about 10 minutes later, knock
police.
On the door.
Hi.
Knock on the door. And so they gave him a very stiff warning. And
I'll bet they did.
And he said, okay.
And a pistol whipping.
He said, I won't fly this drone anymore.
Again.
Never again.
Yeah, can you imagine the two cops down there going, weren't you watching? I thought it was the 13th floor. No, it was the 14th. No, it's three over. Jeez. That's crazy. Unbelievable.
So this guy works for Amazon. Amazon's trying to get drones.
Was he doing some product testing?
That's not going to happen.
I don't think so.
This drone stuff's out of control, Doc. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I know. You're right.
It's out of control.
It is.
I mean, I went to the Air and Space Museum for the first time in a couple of years. They've got the Predator drones now in the Air and Space Museum.
They do?
Yes. Predator drones. They got a couple other drones in there. I was quite amazed by that. I went, wow, that is a big drone.
See, this now opens up. I hadn't even thought about this. Mm-hmm. Your drone has like a 1,400-foot maximum distance from which you can go. So if you're standing on the ground, you could go straight up 1,400 feet. But if you're on the roof of a building now,
you could go even higher.
You can
How does that
work?
Okay. Yeah.
You could go higher. That's right.
It's a signal. You're up, and so it's a signal, I guess. I'm just paraphrasing what the doc would say.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And if you want to go higher, you could probably hack the transmitter and boost the power. violate.
Not that that would ever happen.
You would never do that.
Violate FCC regulations, which of course, I would never do.
You wouldn't soup up a 55
I would never
Chevy.
Violate any FCC. Talking on the radio station, I would never violate an FCC regulation.
Never.
Never.
No. No. I know you, Doc. I know you very well. You would never do something like that.
Yeah. That's amazing.
I know.
You can get a drone at 7-Eleven now.
At 7-Eleven. I looked at the box twice to make sure I just wouldn't see it like it was a toy.
Why? You should have bought it. You could expense it. Just think of the story
okay,
you could
boss.
Do.
Okay, buddy.
How much was it?
I didn't even look at the price. I was just floored that it was right
go,
there.
Go. Go now. Run like check the wind. We have 15 minutes. You need to find out.
Well, I'm going to be, in the next couple weeks, I'm going to be bringing in the Google Glass, so we'll have it on the here, actually, really? in the studio.
Oh, so you're going to be a glass hole.
Yeah, that's right. No, I know. I'm going to bring it.
That was his joke. That wasn't mine.
I'm going to bring in the somebody from the IT department. I'll bring in a Stratford really? Glass hole. Yeah, and he'll talk about it.
Yeah, they need to come down.
How much does those cost?
$1,500.
I'll bet he expends those.
They're $1,500. But what,
and that's just to photograph like everything you're doing all day?
But no, what we're trying to do is see whether we can actually use it for in the classroom, like right. like the teacher could like do culinary demos,
right.
or use it for creating content for the online.
You still
platform.
Doing that Friday afternoon feast?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah. It's now on Thursday. Now
it's Thursday.
Don't show up on Friday.
It's on. Yeah.
Don't do Friday.
Nobody's ever there.
It's on Thursday. It's on Thursday because
traffic's terrible on Friday.
Yeah. Well, some people only eat. Fish on
Thursdays.
Friday.
So get out of here. No. The Catholic kids have to have the fish, and the Protestants have the sloppy
that's
joes.
Right. It's,
I know, that's
true. So if we
handle it on Thursday, everybody can have
everybody
whatever
gets
they
a sloppy
want.
Joe.
Well, that's okay. Right. Well, you need a Catholic-only table, which is what
oh, yeah, that would be. That would go over well.
All right, Doc, that was all I just wanted to say about the 7-Eleven scoop. I know you don't go into 7-Eleven scoop.
Well, I do. Occasionally I get a Slurpee. I'm waiting for you to get your iPhone
energy.
6. I'm waiting for you to walk in with your iPhone 6, Dave.
He does a 20-hour.
I think you're right.
The iPhone 6, is that really happening?
Yeah, it's
that's just a bigger screen, right?
It's a bigger screen, that's it. But they also have some...
Because they're worried about Samsung, because those Samsung...
Yeah, so they got a four... See, the iPhone 5 is a 4-inch screen, and then this... So they got two screens, 4.7-inch and 5.5-inch.
I got a mini pad, I don't care.
Yeah,
I bought
I'm
a mini
you.
Pad just last week. I don't care.
I know. I'm with you. That's all I need.
I don't need
a phone
a big
and
phone
an iPad
pocket.
Mini. That's all I need. That's exactly right. I mean, Doc, I see other people walking around with these giant Samsung phones. I'm like, where do you put that?
You remember the Etch a Sketch? It's as big as a stinking Etch a Sketch. I don't need an Etch a Sketch in my pocket.
No. And you're making a call like this.
Yeah, hello.
Right?
That's right.
That's stupid. No. Get the mini pad and get the iPhone accessory. That's
yeah. I think that makes sense.
You're agreeing with me, Doc?
Yeah.
He's running a fever.
I actually don't like a giant phone.
I don't
because,
either.
Because I just use it for email.
I use earbuds, right. So it doesn't matter to me what the phone. If I need to see something, I get on the mini pad.
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly right.
Can I be excused now?
Yeah, you can be excused.
Can I leave class? Can I get a note from the
deacon? But you need to tell us where the 7-Eleven is. Right.
Today we're going to talk about chocolate. I should have brought in some chocolate samples.
You should have. We also have a bread experiment, which we've never done, and we should do that in a future show.
We're going to get to that bread experiment.
Yes.
Now, chocolate has an interesting history. Cocoa originated in the Amazon at least 4,000 years ago. So the cocoa and chocolate really came from our neck of the woods. They didn't come from Europe.
Right.
Now, it was used by the Mayan culture as early as the 6th century A.D. The Mayans call it chacacuacal tree.
It's easy for you to say.
That's where the word chocolate comes from. And the word, it comes from a Mayan word, based on a Mayan word that means bitter water. Because if you grind up the cocoa bean, it tastes fairly bitter before you add sugar.
Mm-hmm.
To Mayans, cocoa pods symbolized life and fertility. So much of their artwork, their fertility artwork, had featured cocoa pods prominently in the art. Now, the Aztecs, which also were an Indian culture that actually very closely related to the Mayas, believed that wisdom and power came from eating the fruit of the cocoa tree. Now, in fact, the Aztecs believed that the god who created their culture went to paradise before he came down to earth, plucked a branch of a cocoa tree from paradise and brought it down to earth and planted it.
Mm-hmm.
So the Aztecs believed the cocoa tree was the tree of the gods.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the use of cocoa or of chocolate worldwide didn't really go worldwide until the discovery of America by the Europeans. Of course, the Aztecs discovered America a long time ago, but when the Europeans discovered America.
It was already there.
Yeah, it was already
but
there.
But now it's ours.
Yeah, it had already been discovered by other people. But when they discovered it, that's
from
when,
their perspective.
From their perspective. Yeah. Now, the court of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella got its first look at the principal ingredients of chocolate when Columbus returned in triumph from America. Of course, King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella were King and Queen of Spain. Now, during his conquest of Mexico, Cortes found the Aztec Indians using cocoa beans in a preparation of a royal drink of the realm,
chocolate. So chocolate actually started out as a drink.
Yes, it was a drink only.
Uh-huh.
And chocolatl meant warm liquid. Now, in 1519, Emperor Montezuma, who was Aztec, reportedly drank 50 or more portions a day of chocolate.
Thus the phrase Montezuma's Revenge. Huh?
And he drank them in golden goblets because this was a drink of the gods.
The original big gulp, I guess.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Now, he served the chocolate to his Spanish guests, also in great golden goblets, because he thought perhaps they're gods, too. He treated it like a food that was fit for true royalty.
Mm-hmm.
But Montezuma's chocolatl was very bitter because they didn't add sugar. They just ground up the cocoa bean. Now, to make the concoction more agreeable to Europeans, Cortes added sugar.
Of course.
It did not take long before chocolate was viewed in Europe as a healthy food.
Sugar makes everything better, doesn't it?
And then somebody got the idea that if you heat it up, it tastes even better. So they had hot chocolate.
Hot chocolate.
Hot chocolate in Europe.
Wow.
In 1657, many famous English chocolate houses appeared when chocolate moved across the canal over there between France and England.
Mm-hmm.
In 1730, chocolate had dropped in price because initially it was very expensive. But they started growing a lot more chocolate. They planted more chocolate trees and they had more chocolate produce. And it fell within the financial reach of all. Now, the invention of the cocoa press in 1828 reduced the prices even further. Now, in 1847, an English company introduced something really innovative, the idea of eating chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
It was chocolate that was solid, and it was developed through kind of a fondue process. It was smooth and velvety, and instead of drinking it, you ate it.
So it became portable.
That's right. The second development occurred in 1876 in Vevey, Switzerland, when Daniel Peter devised a way of adding milk to chocolate, thus creating milk chocolate.
That is my favorite right there.
That's right. Now, in 1765, this would be pre-revolutionary New England to be exact, the first chocolate factory was established in the U.S.
So how about that?
So it finally made its way back from Europe back to America, and they had the first chocolate factories. And eventually, the biggest chocolate factory in the U.S. was situated up at Hershey, Pennsylvania. Hershey, Pennsylvania. We got the Hershey Bar.
Which, of course, if you've never been there, you can actually go for a tour of the Hershey chocolate plant and learn more about the process.
That's right.
You know, we have a lot of inquiring minds in our audience, and that would be a great thing to do. It's a nice day trip.
It is a very nice day trip. I've been to the chocolate factory.
Have
there,
you?
And, then,
and you know what? They have free samples.
They do.
Yeah, don't you know?
It is very nice. So there's all you ever wanted to know about chocolate, starting in America, going to Europe, and then
back
to America in 1765.
That's all we have time for this week, so go get yourself a chocolate bar, and we'll see you next week here on Tech Talk Radio.
Commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and Federal News Radio.